Welcome to Inclusion Bites, your sanctuary for bold conversations that spark change. I'm Joanne Lockwood, your guide on this journey of exploration into the heart of inclusion, belonging, and societal transformation. Ever wondered what it truly takes to create a world where everyone not only belongs, but thrives? You're not alone. Join me as we uncover the unseen, challenge the status quo, and share stories that resonate deep within. Ready to dive in? Whether you're sipping your morning coffee or winding down after a long day, let's connect, reflect, and inspire action together. Don't forget, you can be part of the conversation too. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seachangehappen.co.uk to share your insights or to join me on the show. So adjust your earbuds and settle in. It's time to ignite the spark of inclusion with Inclusion Bites. And today is episode 111 with the title Hydrating Humanity. And I have the absolute honour and privilege to welcome Hannah Bellamy. Hannah is the Managing Director of Charity Water. When I asked Hannah to describe her superpower, she said, getting people to see and care about ongoing issues in the world. Hello, Hannah. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Joe. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolute pleasure. So, Hannah, Hydrating Humanity, that is sounds like a fascinating thing. So tell us more.
Yeah, of course. So Hydrating Humanity, I think what lots of people don't realise is that while we all need water, not everybody has access to it. So there's 703 million people living around the world who don't have access to clean water. And it's not just about being able to drink it and being able to have, you know, turn on the tap and drink that water. Not having clean water is an issue which affects education, it affects opportunity. It's the biggest killer of children under the age of five. And really, it's a social injustice which affects women and girls in particular.
Those are some staggering numbers. The biggest killer of children under the age of five.
Yeah.
Wow. And 703 million people across the globe not having access to clean water. And I suppose what's going on in my head, and the biases and the stereotypes are probably in my head, is poverty in Africa. But it goes beyond that, doesn't it?
It does go beyond that. So it can happen in all sorts of places and pop up in different pockets. So, you know, we'll definitely find that in some vast countries. So if you think in North America, for example, there'll be areas where people don't have piped water to their homes. But we as an organisation, Charity Water, we do focus on countries that are low down on the UN's Human Development Index, because those are where people really need help. So about 80% of our work is in Africa, about 20% in Southeast Asia. But that's not where the problem is completely isolated to. I mean, we hear about it now, unfortunately, in war zone situations. That's not the type of thing we go and fix, because for us, we're working in places where we want to have long-term systemic change to help remove people from the poverty that you're imagining. So clean water is the first step to help people remove people from poverty.
Yeah, because it is a tool in warfare, isn't it, where you remove utilities, so you remove sanitation, food, water supply in order to get your opposing side to capitulate or give in through suffering, starvation, dehydration. So, yeah, I'd never really put it into that context before. But it is one of those tools. And I guess if you go back, I'm just thinking, we're going back into ancient medieval history. We've got, we used to starve people out of their castle, didn't we? And through lack of water.
Yeah, sieges. Yeah. Which feels like it, in some ways there's instances similar to that now, perhaps. But the interesting thing there is, because when people read it in the news and it's happening in that type of war scenario, it feels like something new and people are horrified by it. People are horrified by the idea of not having access to clean water in that situation. But what I want people to do is to take that horror and think, actually, there's people around the world, like I said, that over 700 million people like that on a day-to-day basis. And really, it's something we know how to fix. So what I really want people to do is to hear that and think, well, oh my goodness, that's shocking. How can we allow that to happen? And oh my goodness, it's something we can change if we just invest in the right way. We can fix this problem and we can save those children under five. We can impact those women's lives. So it's how do we take that horror and refocus it into action?
And is there a, I mean, you emphasize the word clean water.
Mm.
Is there a marked difference between clean water, dirty water, and no water? So a lot of these areas may have water, but it's not suitable for drinking or sanitary to clean and wash in. Is that the challenge, or having water at all is the challenge?
In the countries we work in, both, and it can change wildly between seasons, rainy season, dry season, everything like that. So if you think about somewhere like Bangladesh, there are instances where definitely there is too much water. It's just not the right water. So it can be extremely dirty. And actually what we need to do is think about clean water solutions, which are adaptable in times of flooding, but that still reach the clean water as opposed to the dirty water, which is flooding. There's other places we work where in the Sahel region, a desert region, in West Africa, where it's a really harsh conditions. And in the dry season, there is no water. I mean, you can dig really, really deep down. And what we find is people there may have really old wells, which they're able to sometimes gather water from, but they can dry up and the water that does come is really dirty. And they've usually walked miles and spent hours, which is why women are so affected, to collect that water. So what we want to do is drill deep down to a stable place in the water table and make it simple to pump that water up to the surface, and then to have that water source close to people's homes, so women aren't walking, usually, you know, if you think barefoot, very hot ground, long distances, often unsafe. So what we do hear about is different forms of violence they could encounter, to collect water, back-breaking work to bring it back, and you think balancing it there on your head or sometimes strapping it to the back, bringing it home, having that water be dirty, having that make your children sick, having that make you sick, and then have to do it again and multiple times a day. So for us, it has to be a sustainable clean water source within 30 minutes round trip, whole trip. We want to take less than 30 minutes when people need to get water, and it has to be safe and it has to be clean.
What I just heard you say there is, so women are making this journey potentially half a day, 20, 50 miles, I guess, is that sort of distance. And when they're bringing the water back, that water itself is not necessarily clean. It could also be dirty as well. So they've gone to get this water and now they're bringing in dirty water. How do they, will they boil it? Will they sanitize it somehow? Or will they just, it would just be dirty and they consume it as is?
Again, different communities will have different ways of doing it. Sometimes they'll filter it through some cloth, which obviously would remove some of the larger debris, but not the germs. And that's the real issue, because often what we'll see, so there's a woman called Mulatani who lives in Malawi. She used to walk up and down this quite intrepid ravine in her flip-flops to go and collect water from a stream. It was a stream that would be really a trickle at certain points. So she's there, you're having to dig down, get in a queue, take that water from the source. And what around that will be goats, cows, whatever other animals want to come. And so if a cow is weeing in that water, pushing it through a cloth, which may not be clean in itself, is not removing the germs. It will remove some of the leeches, other nasty bits, stone, everything else, but it's not clean, safe water.
So the pollution predominantly in these sources, because they're water holes, is likely to be animal waste, and human waste, I guess, in some areas. River pollution and things.
Exactly. Animal waste, human waste, whatever pollution has been in there. I mean, it would be, for me, where I live, my closest water source would be the River Thames. So it would be like me walking down to the Thames, taking water from that and using that for my family. And I wouldn't, but you just think I wouldn't, but there's no choice within this matter.
Yeah. Water is so fundamental to life. Exactly. You can go hungry, but you can't go thirsty for more than a few days, can you?
No, exactly. You can't. And then you start to realise it's not only that, it's keeping clean, keeping everything else around you clean, and the additional health benefits that provides, and the dignity as well. Just feeling clean with yourself, that your clothes aren't dirty, that you're not dusty. And we find that often in the communities where we work, there's real pride after receiving clean water, because people are able to find that dignity. I visited some fairly early on within my first year working at Charity Water, I went to Ethiopia, to the northern region called Tigray, and went to a couple of different communities within a day. And I found it was the first time I saw it so starkly. The first community that we visited, the children had clean water. It was somewhere we'd worked, we delivered a clean water source. Our local partner was working there. And everybody in both communities, hugely welcoming, people dancing. It's, you know, it's a joyous moment when we go into these communities and meet with people and talk and hear their stories. In that first community, everybody's dressed in these beautiful, vibrant fabrics. They're dancing around there, and you can see the shine in the children's eyes. We had a football match. You're doing all these things. The next community, we drove along some very dirt roads, couldn't get up there. We had to sort of hike up some mountainsides and go meet the children there. And they didn't have clean water. We walked down to a sort of stream where they were able to collect water, but it was dirty. We saw that and what it looked like and how they collected it, you know, the scoops they were using and everything else. But the biggest contrast was just same vibrant cloth underneath, but very dusty and dirty. The children's faces, you know, they weren't able to keep themselves clean in the same way, the hair, everything else. So you soon realize yes, it's about health and drinking and the hydration side of it. It's also just about how you want to live and the comfort level and the dignity it brings.
What are the symptoms? Or so you were drinking and consuming or washing and bathing in unclean water. What does that do to the human body in these cases? You know, is it dysentery, cholera, all mm-hmm. these kind of diseases and things?
All sorts of diseases, and it's sort of an endless list. What we see very often and what affects the young children in particular, it's diarrhea. So they have extremely runny stomachs, and unfortunately, in a situation where you're not able to then have enough water and keep consuming enough water, or if the water you're then consuming is also making you sick, diarrhea can be fatal. And that's the really, really sad thing. You know, generally here, if my kids get diarrhea, it's a very unpleasant experience, but that's the end of it. It's maybe 24 hours, 48 hours of discomfort, not very pleasant, but we're able to. And then the idea that actually in another country, the only water that if I was the mother would be able to give to my child could continue exacerbating that, and the child can die, which does happen. It's heartbreaking.
Bit like being lost at sea, and you've got all that salt water around you, and nothing yes. to drink, sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah, heartbreaking.
So when someone's got water that is in various, I mean, not all dirty water is equal. I guess there must be hierarchies of really, really dirty to mm-hmm. okay. So there must be different treatments and different ways of tackling different pollutants, I guess. So what does it cost? I mean, I'm in my head, I'm thinking little tablets or something you put in the water to disinfect or to clean. Is that the sort of solutions you're looking at to clean water, if you like?
It's not. So because what we're trying to do is, so at Charity Water, every single time we work in a community and we work with a local partner, so we don't do the work ourselves. We fund local organisations to do that. And we want to, and we do, put a pin on a map on our website with GPS coordinates, and we say this community now has clean water. So it can't be something which could run out in that way. So it looks different in every community because it has to be appropriate both to the water source, but also to what's appropriate for that community in terms of can they get the right nuts and bolts and fix it and maintain things. So in some places it's digging down to, like I said, so we need to be able to get a truck in there, have it really drill deep down, find the water, and that water then will be clean usually. So once you get down to in the groundwater, it's going to be clean. Pump it up. We will make sure and test it, make sure there's no traces of unwanted things coming through from that water. And then that's drinkable water, that's potable water. In other places, it is a case of having a filter. And actually, you ask what it costs. So again, it varies per thing. But a typical, you know, drilling a well with a hand pump, that's going to be about £8,000-£10,000. In other places, so Cambodia, for example, we use a biosand filter program in lots of places we're working. And in that, we're helping community members to build their own filters, which will work within their homes. And again, how to maintain that, how does that work? And we know they're working for 10 plus years, this structure that has then been built within their homes, and they can collect water, pour it in there, and it will come out completely clean. But the dirty water itself looks different in different contexts. We actually got our creative team. So we are in Bangladesh at the moment, and they did something we haven't done for quite a while, which was take a microscope with them. And they took a microscope and they've taken it into one of the schools, and they've got some of the water that the kids were drinking, and they've put it under the microscope, and there are things moving. You know, it's alive, that water that they're drinking, all different shapes and sizes. And, you know, that's really active, and you look at that and you think, I don't want to drink that and put that in my body. And then they look at what they've used there, and that's another different type, but another filtration system, and they're able to see that there's nothing there. It's just it's dead, which doesn't sound good, but that's what you want with your water. You do not want living things in your water.
So dead things are good
in that way. So
it's about killing off the bacteria or the microbes. Because when they're alive, they react with the gut, and that's what causes the diarrhea, etc. But dead things are inert then, and they go straight through.
Yeah. I say dead, I just mean there's nothing there. So they've actually been filtered out. So knowing that you've killed them, they've literally got caught. They're no longer within that. They said that it just doesn't look alive. The water doesn't look alive like it does when you.
So it's not the swimmy things that are now inert.
Now dead. No. There are no swimmy things anymore.
Right.
So they don't want swimmy things.
I'm fascinated by how the water that you're drilling down is clean, because you know it's obviously in the earth, in the there's going to be dust and bits and pieces in it, and presumably water must filter through the earth, permeate down, and that would bring down pollutants with it. Are these water tables coming from rainfall through clean rivers from the top of mountains all the way underground? Is that how they get cleaned through evaporation and then perspiration down?
So this is slightly beyond my. This is partly why we're at local partners. So my hydrogeology is minimal, but I know it is clean. And often I think it's gone through so many layers of rock. So a bit like when we put the biosand filters in Cambodia, it's a similar thing where it's gone through so many layers of rock to get there that it's become clean. And also it's dark down there. If you think there's no light to encourage any life in that sense. So it's also had that experience. But I am that's a piece I'm not very well informed on.
I'm just curious. No, I get that. Yeah, I suppose you've got all that pressure. You've got the filtration, as you say. There's no light. It's probably a bit cold as well.
Yeah.
So what are the challenges? I mean, obviously, I guess money is a challenge. But there must be logistical challenges, because you're often working in very rural or out of the way areas. Mm-hmm. These communities are not on the main road, so you probably have to find them and put infrastructure in there, in electricity maybe. That they may not have that either.
Yes, so most communities won't have electricity, and that would often come after water. So often what we find is that after clean water comes, the next step within a community may be to replace their roofing. If they've had straw roofs and things like that, if there's enough money, they will replace it with tin roofs. So it's better in terms of keeping the rain out and things like that. Then the next step often may be something like electricity, but that usually comes a little bit later. In terms of logistical challenges, I think we're so lucky in our model, in that we work with local experts and local partners. So they're able to, they know the best solution, and they know how to adapt their work for the environment. So they overcome those. But also so many we come across. So Murtani, the woman I mentioned earlier, when our team first went to her community, they were really keen to have clean water because they'd seen it in a neighbouring village, and they really wanted clean water within their own village. But while you don't need the electricity to drill down, you do need a considerable sized rig. You know, the type of rigs you'd normally see on a building site or something else, they need to be able to get hundreds of metres down to the ground. So huge drilling piece on it needs to come through. It's run on diesel or whatever else it is, and it needs to be able to get right down in there. And so what they didn't have was a road for this drilling rig to be able to get there. And actually the ravine, which they'd been walking over, Murtani and her friends have been walking over and navigating to be able to get their stream water from, is what the issue was, because you couldn't build a road over that very easily. So to overcome that, it's not us overcoming that, actually people really want water. So when they realized that was an issue and a drilling rig couldn't get in because of this, what they decided to do was every family within that community nominated one family member to work together and build a road. And they did, and they gathered all the materials, they did it. And so our local partner will go in and support them and make sure they're planning it right. Is it going to work, the drilling rig? How does this, you know, what they know, because they've done it in other communities, the different, you know, layers of dirt and rocks and everything else you need. So they'll work with them to do that. But it's often this partnership. So it's us, it's our local partners and experts, and then it's the community themselves are all working together to bring clean water and overcome any of the logistical challenges. And then the challenges we face, the bigger challenge for me, the challenges we face is a bit like I mentioned earlier about when we think about wartime and people not having clean water, that's a shock. And so the world pays attention. I was reading just yesterday about habituation, and that there's, as humans, we are, it's a bit like boiling a frog in the sense that we become used to something, we stop seeing it. And that's what's happened with these type of issues. And unfortunately, where I often use the statistic that it's the leading killer of children under the age of five, because if you said someone, do you want to fix the biggest killer of children under the age of five? Do you want to neutralize that, save those children's lives, nursery school aged kids? Everyone will say, yes, everyone wants to do that. And we can do that, but they don't see it and hear it anymore because this is an ongoing, you know, it's throughout our lifetime, there's been this issue.
I suppose I grew up, well, maybe didn't grow up, but I was around with Live Aid and Bob Geldof and Feed the World, and images of young African children with pot bellies, malnutrition, and the drought related, because obviously the drought causes lack of crops and lack of food. So it's kind of, it's a bit of everything really. So you, not only are you trying to give people water to drink, you've also got to find water to grow crops and other things, which is again a massive challenge in its own right. And you can't be putting sewage contaminated water on crops, because that again just creates the problem in there as well. So it's the whole, I get it, it's the whole cycle of humanity, that living in those communities, giving them life. And it's almost, you know, using Maslow as an example, is the hierarchy of needs. It's that really basic, you can't, as you said, you can't wash your face or clean your clothes if you haven't got enough water to drink. And it reflects in their personas, how you perceive them. So
And you can't wash your hands, which I think, you know, during COVID, that's something we all became very aware of, was, and we've always known it, but the importance of washing your hands throughout the day, a particular moment. So if you can't wash your hands, the spread of diseases, you know, it increases.
You kind of take it for granted, don't you, that you don't even think about washing your hands. You just, it becomes, there's the tap. I mean, we get frustrated if we go into the toilet and there's the soap dispenser doesn't work with you.
Come on,
I've got to walk out with shaking my hands and get the drips off.
Waving our hands at the sensors to try and get the water, you know, all those things these days.
Those first world problems that we get kind of excited about when it doesn't work. And these people are, they don't have the luxury of having water to drink, let alone to wash their hands in.
Exactly.
So, Where do you get most of your funding from? Because this is not a cheap thing, is it? This is big infrastructure investments. How do you raise the funds for this?
So as an organisation, as a charity, we have a unique model. So we have two separate bank accounts. We have the water bank account, and then we have the overheads bank account. And the reason we do this is our founder Scott Harrison, when he first set up the charity, he realized that people don't trust charities. It's a real problem that people think, I don't know where my money's going. Especially when it's going overseas, what's happening with it? How do I know it's gone to the right place? Who's paying for your laptop? You need to fly here. You know, our team have to fly places. How much is that costing? So to overcome all of that, we have these two separate bank accounts, water and overheads. And if you went on to our website today, if anyone decided to go onto the website and give to Charity Water, 100% of that money will go into our water bank account. We take that and we grant every single penny. We even refund any credit card fees or anything else. We'll go to our local partners and be invested in clean water solutions. So that money comes from a couple of different places. So a lot of it comes from everyday people. So we have people who learn about this and they really want to make a difference. So they'll sign up to what we call the Spring, which is to give every single month. So I always think of it as like a subscription for good. You've got your Netflix, you've got whatever else it is you're giving to every month. you sign up there and actually give every single month and know that you're doing good in the world. And 100% of it has gone up over there. So we have that. We do have people who fundraise, who do races, who do any, you know, whatever it is that's fun for them. So they go and fundraise, again, 100%. And then we have businesses we work with. So people like Uniqlo, Stanley, the drink vessels, a number of other different businesses, Aveda, the hair salons. They will give to us, either they'll fundraise with their employees or their customers, or they will from their corporate donations. And then the final piece would be wealthier individuals who are able to say, I want to sponsor clean water for one community, or clean water for one school, or clean water for one health clinic. And then we'll work with them on that and provide them with that reporting process to say, great, okay, you want to give £10,000. I have projects that need funding in Malawi, Rwanda, et cetera, and I will work with them on the list and what do they, you know, and so we'll work together to make sure that matches. So that's the water, and that's the bulk of what we do and the bulk of what we need. But we always have to balance it, obviously, with our overhead. And so the majority of our overheads is funded by, again, those wealthy donors. So philanthropists, they've often been founders of businesses, been very successful. They understand investing in the business processes and systems and structures and staff to generate and be the engine of doing the rest of it. So they sign up to what we call the well. They give to us usually once a year for 3 years. Plus, they'll commit to 3 years. And they're very much part of our community. We report to them a bit like investors. So there is no return for them beyond the amazing feel good. And this is how many people we've impacted this year, thanks to investing. But that money comes from there. And then we do actually also add in gift aid now to that as well, because it's a much more sustainable way of us growing. Because otherwise you don't always balance out. Otherwise the water can do really well. You need to have the overheads doing just as well to be able to use that money effectively.
I like that. That's quite a really enlightening governance model to do that, and fundraising model. Because too often charities get criticised for salaries and, as you say, flights. And you know, I know running a business, and you have to pay people. You have to pay people correctly.
Yeah.
It's a charity that does good, but the people themselves aren't charities. You're not a charity. You have to live your life. And if you're going to attract great people who can make a fantastic difference, those great people have a worth. And we can't be all altruistic and do it for nothing, can we?
No, exactly. People sometimes ask that and say, some people are surprised sometimes when you have a salary working for a charity, but I'd have to work somewhere else otherwise. You know, that I have to work to buy food and pay my own water bills and, you know, have a home and my kids and everything else. And my husband's a doctor in the NHS. So, you know, between us, we're both doing what we can.
But some of these countries you're working in, they don't have stable governments. There is kind of corruption and issues, if you like, politically within that their territory. Mm. Do you have troubles working within some of those jurisdictions, or pretty much you're left alone? Because I can just imagine that there's bribes and corruption that have to, or people using your facilities or services for the wrong purpose, if you like. Mm. Is that something you have to be really careful of?
So it's something you need to always be aware of. So again, because it's often not us, it's a local organisation, it's a bit different where we're working with those people, because they are known within that system and they are wanted, and the work they're doing is very valued. But of course you always have to be aware of that. So we have a separate, they're almost an isolated team who we call program finance. So our programs team are the ones who work with the local partners on making sure the work is long-term, robust, that we're scaling it, everything else. The programs finance, they sit slightly separately, and they're auditing everything. So they're going in and checking how the funds have been used, have been used responsibly, can we see X, Y, and Z to prove this? So a bit like any nonprofit or charity does generally in terms of reporting, we are really drilling down, and we have long-term partners so we can get, because then you build up that trust as well, and you know what works for each side. But you know, we pay a great deal of attention to that stuff, because we believe very strongly that the donors should feel absolute joy to know that you know, if you give, I want you to know absolutely that you've given clean water to somebody on the other side of the world, and you should feel amazing about that, and that's what's happened with your money. So you feel very strongly about that, and then feel really strongly that the person who, you know, like we've talked about, Mulitani's community, they built a road. You know, they deserve whatever money is being sent to help them, that for that to reach them, because they're also working extremely hard and will be dedicated to this water point. So on both sides, for us, it's really important it runs as smoothly as possible.
Yeah, I get that. So you're not out there trying to break rock yourselves, if you like. Mm-hmm. You're working with local people who understand. So not only are you providing clean water, you also, I'm guessing through this, providing jobs and injection of money into their economies as well.
Yes, that's we want it all to be. And some local partners we work with, not only do they, we'll work with them and there'll be a local organisation employing local people, then we'll also arrange for different local partners have different expertise to get to know each other, to learn from each other, to also help on that side of things. And we also have, I think it's in, I'm trying to think which country it's in now. I think it's Rwanda, but I may be wrong. One of our local partners is that they even invest in things like local masons who will be able to create the stone base that they need. So they helped train the local masons to do that and to be able to supply it. So it has complete knock-on effects in terms of working through local people. And the other thing I would say is we know that when you invest in clean water infrastructure, like I said, it brings opportunities to places, and you see the electricity, the different roofs, everything else. But actually, it's proven that for every £1 invested, there's £4 return in the local economy. So, and that's just the start of it from what we...
Presumably, so you've been operating and helping communities for several years now. How long has your project been going?
So Charity Water globally has been going for 17 years, and then we've been in the UK since 2018.
Presumably, obviously, you've made a lot of difference to a lot of communities over that time. Is there an end to it? I mean, it's almost like an infinite bridge, path. You have to, you keep painting it, and there's always another community to handle. Is it sustainable to keep doing this forever, if you like? Because I can't predict an end.
No, so I think there's two things there. First of all, we have a saying within the organization which is, don't be afraid of work that has no end. So we are impacting. Each time you impact a community, you've done something, you've achieved something. And actually, when we began, 1 billion people didn't have access to clean water. It's not all thanks to us, it's thanks to a whole load of organizations, but now it's 703 million. So progress has been made, and our belief is that we can end the water crisis in our lifetime if everybody really pulls together. This isn't there's so many other causes out there, so to do with climate change and what do we do about climate change, what the different cancers, how do we tackle that. There's all these different things that people that need huge amounts of research and development and iterative processes and learning to get to a point where we'd even would know how to solve some of it, whereas that's not the water. We know how to fix it. It's there. It's about investing community by community, school by school, health clinic by health clinic, until we meet that. It will get more expensive as we go, because the communities that left are likely to be the most rural, the most hard to reach, the most in need. But we don't stop until it's done.
You mentioned climate change there, and most people associate that with rising sea levels. But that brings its own challenge, doesn't it? Because it's the wrong type of water. You could be polluting water tables and sources of water that you're currently relying on.
It's yes. So what's one of the things we really look at, and it was interesting. I was speaking with Brian, who leads all our programmatic work, and he was saying that many of us feel like the world is unstable and flapping around a little bit, and things are surprising us. Often these communities, because they're more impoverished and they're struggling in different ways, they're at the end of the tail end of that flapping around. So if you think about something moving, so they're experiencing real extremes. And so what we find is somewhere like Malawi, we've talked about, they'll have extreme droughts, a lack of water. And so in those cases, we need to make sure we're drilling deep enough for there to be long-term sustainable clean water for them, and that we've thought about how this shifts over time as well. And then they're also experiencing, huge storms that are bringing unheard of amounts of rain, strong winds, and destroying infrastructure. So we also have to make sure things are built really robustly. And if there is things like flooding, that that the systems remain safe and that the dirty water isn't flooding and infiltrating the clean water, everything else. All of this has to be taken into account. And actually, if we overlay a map of where we currently work, and so we're in 22 countries, where we currently work, and the countries which are most impacted right now by climate change, already feeling the effects of it, they pretty much sit on top of each other. So it's often in these countries they're experiencing it right now, climate change. And what we can do is, if you give them an adequate, safe, long-term access to clean water, you're removing one of the real difficulties for them, because at least they have that, and then everything, you know, you can rebuild things, you can work, but you need to have the access to the clean water.
I'm fascinated. I'm just thinking, as you were describing, drilling down to these water tapes and making sure there's enough volume of water down there to be sustaining a community. Presumably the communities themselves are not consuming water on a vast scale. This is what, 20, 30 households, few litres per person per day type thing.
Yeah.
So how much water do you need to locate for it to be considered a worthwhile, sustainable water source? Pris, that's quite technical. You may not know the answer to that, but it's what's going on in my head, I suppose.
Yeah, no, and people often ask us because they'll read about water tables drying up. And I think, you know, it's something that definitely the US is experiencing right now, and they're starting to be concerned about the consumption of water and what does that mean when they're drawing water from the water table. But you're right, in the communities we work in, you know, there might be a couple of hundred people. They don't have the power showers and flushing toilets and dishwashers and washing machines and everything else. So they're not using huge amounts of water. And actually, generally what causes water tables to fluctuate is industry. So actually, where there's an issue with overuse of water, it tends to be because it's within a manufacturing or some other kind of really, really intense process. It's not about people having water into their homes and what they're doing with it. So it's just not a problem from that sense. They will not deplete the water table just by having access to it.
Do you, I presume, not only are you bringing supply in, you must be putting sanitary and sanitation in to remove the sources of the contamination as well, are you?
So we do. So generally, because of where we're going, you don't need to where you're if you're drilling down, or we're putting the filtration in, and then yes, we are. We do. There's certain places we work where, for example, we're planting trees around because that helps to slow down so that water doesn't suddenly flood, and also again helps to filter it and do different things. So there's different adaptations that can work like that, but we don't normally have to, unless, as I said, it is somewhere like Cambodia or Bangladesh where we're taking that water and putting it through a filtration system.
I appreciate this next thing I want to ask you is not necessarily your core speciality, but I'm sure you have an opinion being in the sector. Is just talking about a lot of stuff going on in the news around the UK at the moment around pollution of rivers through untreated sewage and the water companies not fixing it. I like to be charitable and think, well, they're not out to do bad. They may not be that efficient at doing what they do, but they're not set out to be bad. It must be a massive problem to cope with the volumes and demands of consumers and water users. And how do you think that, you know, we as a community and society in the UK could I don't know, get around that and think about our own water supplies?
I'm not on the water supply side so much, but my background is, so I came into the charitable sector through the corporate sector. So I worked in corporate responsibility. I actually worked for Centrica and British Gas on their corporate responsibility side of things. So I do have a view in the sense of businesses having a duty to do the right thing. And so when you say they don't want to do the wrong thing, I believe that as individual people, the majority of individual people who are in businesses, of course they don't want to do the wrong thing. They want to do right by people and hopefully by the environment. But if the culture, and I don't know this with the different water companies, but if the culture isn't right, if the goals aren't right, if the measurements aren't right, if perhaps legislation around it isn't right, then the decisions being made can lead to harm. And it's really important that the social impact and the environmental impact of things is being measured very clearly and benchmarked, and that you have goals to improve that and to do it. And so I don't know enough about the issue here, but it has to be done, and you know, and perhaps legislation would be the only answer.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the people you're helping in these countries consume very little water per capita per head. Mm-hmm. Whereas in this country and other developed countries, we consume vast amounts of water per head. Even if it's not directly going through our household, but just cleaning our food, watering our garden, all those ways we consume water. And we take it for granted. We have no concept that water isn't free. You know, water to us is free. It's just turn the tap on and it's there. And we get really shocked when we go to Spain on holiday, have to buy bottled water because you can't drink out the tap in the bathroom. Mm-hmm. So we get quite spoiled as consumers in the UK.
Yeah, we do. But I think it comes down to so much of it's overconsumption generally, isn't it? I mean, water's used, huge amounts of water in genes. You know, to manufacture genes, you need vast amounts, especially to get the stonewash effect, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it often isn't about what we're doing at home, although we can all reduce it. And actually, I find my daughter has a shower and she automatically turns off the water every time she's putting shampoo in or washing up. You know, she just does. And she just always has, because she's like, well, I wouldn't waste that. So I'm hopeful, and I do think that the kids are learning differently and starting to think about things differently. So I hope that continues.
I never even thought of turning the shower off between washing my hair, and I kind of just let it flow. I mean, it's not a power shower, it's a gravity shower, but I just kind of let it flow. But yeah, and nothing better than when you're in a nice hotel and the shower, one of those rain showers, it just feels really invigorating. I do it without any thought. You know, I'm starting to become very conscious about recycling plastics and avoiding plastics when I can, but I don't have a water conservation or water care thing in my head at the moment. And I heard there's a World Water Day coming up. Is that trying to bring that in, is it?
So that's about access to water for everybody. So World Water Day, yes, that's something to consider, but actually you consuming less is not going to provide clean water to someone else on the other side of the world. It's not, you know, it's a bit like, you know, news to, I don't think parents do it as much anymore, but, you know, when kids didn't eat their food and they say, there's some starving children who could, you know, it doesn't, one thing does not offset the other. So World Water Day, really, it has a different theme each year. It's a UN day. So, it's part because it's UN development, sustainable development goal number 6 is access to clean water and sanitation for all. So it's about raising awareness for that. This year, I think it's having a theme of peace and how peace and water really play into one another and the importance of one to the other. But we'll be doing, so Charity Water, we always do a lot of fun things for Water Day. So this year, if anyone's in London, we'll be just off Brick Lane unveiling a newly painted mural to try and raise awareness and keep people thinking about it beyond World Water Day.
So, yeah, just picking up what you said there. So me being frugal and turning the shower off doesn't solve the problem in Malawi or the places you mentioned. So I've got to realise that the way I can help is not through personal action as such. Mm-hmm. It's around supporting the causes, lobbying governments, being more aware of the needs of those people, and where possible, supporting, sponsoring, contributing, donating into the causes. Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think, and what's important to me, what I feel like is at the moment, for some reason, I feel like people are very focused on, and I think this often happens in times of difficulty, people are very focused on local causes and charities and food banks and everything else. And we should be. We should all care about our local communities, and not to take away from that at all. But we should think about humanity as a whole and every single person and their value around the world. And think about them, all people as our neighbours, all humanity. So that for me is, if people are thinking about giving, and I hope most people do think about giving, to have that wider piece. So I know one family who always want to give to a cause which is hyper local to them. So they focus on a hyper local cause, they focus on a national cause, and then they focus on an international cause. And for them, they to make sure they're covering everything. So not everybody can give to 3 different organizations, but to have that awareness that where's it really needed? Where's the support really needed?
Yeah. And I would say, because I do work with charities, I've been trustee of a number of charities, and whilst I don't actively give my pennies away to charity, I give my time, which I often think is more valuable than a penny. Yeah, I give you 10 hours of my time, or I raise money, or I give to that way. It's sometimes more valuable. But yeah, you can be giving without actually spending, if you like. Yeah. Advocating, awareness raising, even if it's just social media sharing and commenting and becoming part of a movement to raise the awareness. I appreciate you want cash as well, but creating the awareness is also part of it, isn't it?
Yeah, so what we found, we had some Boston Consulting Group did some pro bono research for us. And what they've said to us is that if people don't know who Charity Water is, they're not going to give. So right now, I want anyone and everyone to know Charity Water. I want them to hear that name, to recognise the logo, so that we become part of the culture here in the UK, and people will then give because they'll trust us and hopefully start, especially because of our 100% way of working, where, you know, they give, they know where their money's going, they know we're going to prove where their money's gone, then they do start to give. Because ultimately, it's the giving which is going to, you know, that's the direct investment in the change.
You're not looking for hours of people's time to come and, you know, fly out to one of these countries and start digging holes or anything like that. So it's very much the local people do that. You're looking for raising funds in this country or funds wherever through gift aids or whatever it may be, creating awareness, creating a movement, creating a momentum, if you like, of awareness of the challenges people are facing. And I guess in the fullness of time, global warming, our climate could change. Other closer to home, people we would see as our close neighbours could also be going through areas where their water tables become sort of, you know, what we consider developed countries now are only, I suppose, only 1 degree centigrade rise in temperature from becoming more barren and more desert-like. And yeah, so it's an interesting topic that I until we started this conversation, I hadn't really explored in my mind around. I just saw it as people in these countries, they have famine, they have drought. I hadn't really considered the whole aspect in their community around this, you know, as you said, walking hours and hours and hours to collect water. The water you collect has then been polluted. It's then consuming dirty water because that's their only choice. And it's not about cleaning the water, it's finding access to the water that is clean already or cleaner. So you're not trying to disinfect or clean water, you're trying to find the better water. And that's really fascinating. It's something, as I say, something I hadn't really explored before.
Yeah, and like you said, it's one of the basic needs that the Maslow Triangle piece, right? That you have to meet this. And then everything else, there's so many things can follow. So, but it does, and it impacts us as people, both from thinking about, yes, those communities and how we have access, but we're always using different water in different ways. Water comes into our lives all over the place. So it's just, I think being grateful for what we have is really important. And you said also about what people can do. The other piece, if they don't have the funding or anything themselves to give, is talk to their employees, talk to their businesses. We often find that actually it's those corporate organisations who do have the funding and are able to help significantly as well. So there's also that side of it, of just thinking beyond individually and ourselves to what can we collectively do.
Yeah, and you say you don't have to support this cause every year or every time you put on your running shoes or whatever else you choose to do. This could just be one of a portfolio of charity causes that you want to support over the course of your life. So yeah, I really like what you said about having that three tier, sort of like the very specifically my village, my locale. Yeah. Sort of the more nationalistic, and then work further afield, some of the bigger causes. And it's opened up another way of thinking that, I donate to this. Yeah. I've still got scope to think about something bigger than me as well and feeling a part of something. Because I had a friend who was doing some work with an organization called Send a Cow. I don't know if you've come across them. It was a concept. It wasn't sending it, the cow, necessarily as meat. They were sending it as the lifeblood of a village to provide milk and to the nurture and care for it. And eventually, yes, when it got to a point where the milk stopped flowing, it may well become food. But the primary thing was it was transforming villages, having this livestock. And they said they went out to see a village and they saw the cows arriving. And some of the children had never seen livestock in that way. Mm-hmm. It brings that whole, as you say, like the smile and the eyes light in the village, not just around that one axe. You're changing lives and changing their quality of life as well, aren't you?
Yeah, you are. And I think that's it. It's about finding that one thing that you can feel really passionate and excited about, and the one thing that can absolutely transform lives that we may take completely for granted, but we can go and I sometimes think about bringing clean water to a community. What we know is that that increases the number of children going to school. And so this clean water can come. And I like to think about a young girl who perhaps before was having to collect water, was too unwell to go to school. She's now going to school. So we know that. Then she's going to school, she's learning. And what we found is when we bring clean water to a school, for example, that increases attendance by 30%. So you impact there. And then we know education is so important. So if you think about this as one child, that child's no longer sick at home, no longer collecting dirty water, now going to school, getting an education. What's she going to do next? Because now she's really educated and she can read well and she can go off and do the next piece that the education provides. Maybe. And when we hear that we speak to some kids and they say, I want to become a doctor. So imagine that girl does become a doctor. And then she starts to save lives. And then, you know, the ripple effects are massive. And so I just, It's how do we find that the catalyst for change and for impacting for good for a long time?
I remember I used to do a lot of work with the community fundraising and back 20, 30 years ago. And I remember working with agencies in India. And they had a program at the time called Freedom Through Education. Mm-hmm. So it's about freeing people through the educational process, and their freedom at the time was their freedom was from legacy colonialism. So they wanted to educate themselves out of that legacy of colonialism. And then we started getting involved with building schools, and then we realized that the priority wasn't just building the school, it was actually building toilets, because without toilets it had a disproportionate impact on young girls. And then we talk about period products and we talk about other things. So you start by thinking about this, and then suddenly quickly you realize there are enablers that help more women and more young girls get involved, because they are the ones that are more disproportionately disaffected by the lack of sanitation, as you say, collecting the water, periods, not as they grow up and things like this. So they've got challenges to go into education. And also the societal expectations of young women as well. We've got to try and overcome that as well. But yeah, it's all kind of little piece of the jigsaw. Often it's the small pieces you don't realise until you realise the big pieces don't work on their own.
Yeah, and I think we, you know, when girls get their periods here, there's, you know, when they're at school and all those things, they're terrified of being embarrassed. And I remember getting into school but you've still got. You've got your individual bathrooms, toilets you can access. You know you've got access to taps. You know you can. You know that from home you'll have everything you need, or perhaps at school the school nurse can help. You know you have all these different things you need, but there's still a terror and for some reason worry about humiliation. And so you take that and you put it into a context where women are already perhaps more oppressed in some ways, and where people could be maybe thought of very differently when they get periods, and all this societal pressure. And then you send them to school without a space to go by themselves, you know, so without any way of cleaning themselves up. And it's unfair on those girls, because you're really taking away their opportunities, and they're staying home because they just don't want to be, it's because of that shame. And so when we work in a school, it's not only about providing clean water. We are working with the school to make sure there's gender specific latrines, enough latrines to cover the whole population, and also usually a separate space for girls to go at, sort of a room they can change in and that they can wash in, and they can do other things they need to do if they have their periods, so that they have that. Again it comes back to dignity, to be honest, and removing any stigma from it. We also like just say, you know, it's a broader conversation about how we're not embarrassed. We shouldn't be embarrassed about it, and everybody gets it, and this is what it looks like. But also allowing people, you don't want to have to raise awareness of it by young girls walking around with mess on themselves. It's just not right.
Oh, and it's trying to change centuries and centuries, probably millennia of stigma and shame and oppression of women. We can't solve that. What we can do is solve toilets, we can create clean water, we can provide spaces for them, products, whilst we're trying to change the world and remove that stigma in the first place. But I see that. Hannah, it's been fascinating. And I knew so little about this when we started the conversation, and I feel quite passionate and evangelistical now. I want to go and talk about this. So it's been absolutely fascinating. So tell us more about the website, the programs. How can people get in contact with you? How can people support you?
So we need all the support we can get. And so I'd love anyone to go to charitywater.org. You can sign up to our monthly newsletter. You can set up a fundraising campaign. You can decide to join our spring and give every single month, whatever works for people. And as I said, every single penny will go on clean water. And then me personally, I'm on LinkedIn, Hannah Bellamy. I love connecting with people, especially if they have a way of helping in terms of through their businesses or anything else that works for them. So, yeah, I hope more people feel evangelical after hearing our conversation.
Fascinating. I'll put all the details on the show notes. And Hannah, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
As we bring this conversation to a close, I want to express my deepest gratitude to you, our listener, for lending your ear and heart to the cause of inclusion. If today's discussion struck a chord, consider subscribing to Inclusion Bites and become part of our ever-growing community, driving real change. Share this journey with friends, family, and colleagues. Let's amplify the voices that matter. Got thoughts, stories, or a vision to share? I'm all ears. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seachangehappen.co.uk and let's make your voice heard. Until next time, this is Joanne Lockwood, signing off with a promise to return with more enriching narratives that challenge, inspire, and unite us all. Here's to fostering a more inclusive world, one episode at a time. Catch you on the next bite.